thank you so much for coming today, being a part of this. It's always an honor to be a part of the workshop in any capacity. This is the 33rd year that my wife and I have attended. We were here at the very first one back in 1976. In fact, my wife spoke on the first workshop in a class teaching teachers how to teach small children. And I can still remember they put her in one of the rooms up the side up here. And they had so many folks in there that they kept piling outside and trying to get in. And so they moved her out to one of these large areas. And then, you have to remember back in 1976, they were concerned then about what to do with all the men who wanted to try to learn how to teach children from a woman teacher. And so they had her here, and they had men lining up all across there. I guess if you got within 40 feet or further back, you were okay. But it was an interesting time. Some things have certainly changed, as they always do. Back when the workshop first started, some of you were part of those days, the emphasis was on the bus ministry. And that's pretty much what fueled the workshop in those days. A lot of things have changed. I remember coming with a group from Deer Park, Texas, and when we pulled in the parking lot, this entire parking area back here was full of buses all the way back to where the Microtel is now located. A lot of great men and great women that were a part of the workshop back then have gone on to their reward, but they certainly left a lot of great memories for us. Some things have not changed. One thing that has not changed, thank the Lord, is this is still a soul-winning workshop. It began that way, and Lord willing, it will never change from that. Before I get into my lesson today, I want to clear up something about myself and the program. It says that I've been preaching in Rogers for 30 years. Well, I've been there for 30 years. That part's correct. But I've only been in the pulpit since about 1997. Prior to that, I served with four wonderful men who preached, and I was involved with various other ministries. And then in 1997, I began to preach full time. I now preach at the 8 o'clock service, and then Marshall Brown and I preach simultaneous services at 10 o'clock. I preach in one facility. He preaches in another facility. You'll hear more about that at a later time. As a matter of fact, you're going to hear from Marshall tomorrow. He's going to come and give you some incredible ideas on how you can put ministry to work in your community, regardless of the size of your congregation, regardless of the size or the age of your city. And he's going to give you, I promise you, some wonderful ideas that you can take back home, and you can begin reaching your community the next week. So be here at 4 o'clock tomorrow. I'll introduce Marshall to you at that time. It's always a great time at the workshop because you get to see people that you don't get to see any other time. Jimmy Burke, who I worshipped with in 1976 in Deer Park, Texas, is here. When I remember Jimmy, he was dark-headed and handsome, and he's gray-headed and a nice guy. I've been asked to speak on the subject, how to improve the church back home. And I apologize if that sounds a little presumptuous, because it sort of sounds like I'm here to tell you something that's better than what you're doing. And I certainly don't want to do that. But I do want to offer some thoughts to you that I believe that if you're not implementing them in your congregation, you can do that. As I mentioned earlier, the first workshops began, and they were fueled by the enthusiasm and the excitement of the bus ministry. Those were great days. For the first time in my Christian life, as a matter of fact, I got off the couch and out into the bus ministry because of Jimmy. He came and knocked on my door one night and asked me if I would consider being involved in the bus ministry. From those early days, the workshop just sort of skyrocketed and took off based upon that, because for the first time, many of us, and I'll be the first one in line to tell you, for the first time, I got out of the house and out of the church building, and I got out into the community that I lived in, and I began to see exactly the way people lived. I discovered, as many of you discovered, that what you see on Sunday morning is not reality. The reality is broken homes exist, broken marriages exist, drug addiction and alcoholism and violence and abuse and sin and filth of every description exist inside those homes that we go by that look so nice on the outside. Christians finally and quickly found themselves feeding hungry people and clothing people who needed clothes and visiting in jails and prison ministries and getting involved with helping folks. We began to provide prescriptions for people who couldn't afford prescriptions. And we began to help people pay utility bills. And we became very much entrenched in what was happening. We were forced to deal with some issues that for a long time we sort of pretended didn't exist. Things like racial prejudice and things like divorce and remarriage. And suddenly, a great many of us were thrust into the reality of our communities, and some great things happened. Those bus ministry days were like no other. And the workshop reflected those times. We came and we were equipped, and we were motivated, and we were challenged to go back home and get involved there and do some things. And for many of us, we saw for the first time the potential of a local congregation. We saw, as Terry talked about this morning, that we actually could have a positive effect on winning souls to Jesus Christ through our efforts. Well, gradually the bus ministry faded away in many places. Unfortunately, when that faded away, so did much of the commitment and the service. I can't speak for you. I can speak for myself and the congregation where I've been for over three decades now. But when the buses left, it's almost as if we felt like we couldn't do evangelism anymore. We depended on the buses so much that if we didn't have a bus, we couldn't visit. And we couldn't get into people's homes. And we couldn't talk to people. And we couldn't help them. And we couldn't teach them. So as the buses disappeared, so disappeared our outreach. I'll say this to you, wherever you live, I promise you, the same people that were in your community back when the buses ran are still there. The hungry are still there. The needy are still there. The lonely are still there. The hurting are still there. And the lost are still there. So the question then becomes, how can we positively reach them? How can we affect them from our congregation, whether our congregation numbers 50 or 200 or 500 or 1,000. Well, I would say that we have to start asking some questions, and I want to ask this question to you. Does your congregation normally have local visitors? I'd say on a regular basis, either every week or at least once or twice a month. Now, if the answer to that is yes, you're obviously doing something that's working, so I'd suggest that you keep doing it. But here's a sad truth about our fellowship. In most congregations, they have very few local guests to come, and in many of them, they never have a one. I spoke with a friend of mine in Oklahoma City yesterday, and we were visiting about this, and I posed the question to him, and Ron said, "You know, Jackie, now that you mentioned it, the church where we worship, I don't think I've seen a strange-looking face, a new face, in 2 years. Now, if that's not happening where you are, then there's something missing in what the congregation's doing to effectively reach the folks there. We launched the bus ministry back in those early 70s on a text from Luke chapter 14 that you're probably familiar with, and I won't read it for the sake of time. I'll sort of paraphrase it. It begins in verse 16 when Jesus said, "A certain man was preparing a feast, and he invited many to attend. And he said to them, to his workers, 'You go out and tell them, come, for all things are now ready.'" And as you go through the story, there were those who made excuses for not coming. And they didn't come for this reason and that reason and this reason. And so the master said, "Well, then if the people that I've invited won't come, then you go out and you find the lame and the hungry and the halt and the blind, and you bring them in that my house may be filled." We launched the bus ministry with that. Toby Quinn was going around preaching. Marvin Phillips was going around preaching and using this text to motivate us to get out. It's a great text. It's a great text today. But there's one short sentence in there that oftentimes we've overlooked, and that simply is that the master said, Now, you go bring them in because all things are ready for them. Many times in the bus ministry, they weren't ready. Many times today, when we finally find a way to reach people and bring them in, we're just not ready for them. There has to be some preparation of us. I would suggest, I want to offer to you two thoughts this morning, and then I want to tell you a story that I hope means a little bit to you because it means a great deal to me. There are two thoughts that I would suggest that we're going to have to implement in our congregations if we're going to make them an outreach church. Number one, we're going to have to focus on people, not on programs. Programs do not reach people. Programs do not win people. People reach people. Effective churches discover the specific needs in their community, and they reach out to them to meet those needs and satisfy them. Now, this may incorporate in your congregation either changing or even scrapping programs that have been in place there for a long, long time, simply because they're not having any effect on people, and the program just becomes an institution that does not produce anything of a positive nature. No church can become everything to everybody, but every church can focus on people rather than maintaining ineffective and non-productive programs. Now, the question that's often asked is, how do we know? How would I know if my church focuses on programs or focuses on people? Well, there are a couple of questions you can ask. Several questions. Let me pose a couple to you. And I'm not opposed to these ministries. I'll just ask them, though, about whether they're effective or ineffective. If where you are, there's a gospel meeting every year. It lasts for a week or 2 weeks, and that goes on every year at the same time. If you can look at that objectively and honestly, does anybody come besides your members and other members of the Lord's church from other areas? In fact, does a pretty small percentage of your congregation even attend? Now, if that's the case, you might need to step back and say, you know what? It's not effective in reaching people. We need to change that if we can. Another question might be to ask, if your Sunday nights and your Wednesday nights are simply miniature imitations of Sunday morning. You have Sunday morning, and then on Sunday night and Wednesday night, you just have a microcosm, a shrunk down version of Sunday morning. And the same thing holds true. Nobody comes but our members. And not very many of them come. And so you might ask yourself, are we focusing on people? Are we focusing just on our program? Back in the 1990s, the early 1990s, our congregation discovered, like most churches, that we do a great job with our teenagers. We do a great job with our couples ministry. But we found out, as many of you have discovered, that those young men and young women who graduate, who don't get married, and who don't go off to college or don't go off into the military, find themselves in this no man's land where they don't fit anywhere. They don't feel comfortable coming into classes with couples, and they don't feel comfortable going with their parents to class. And so they don't find a place to fit in. They sort of drift around, and ultimately, they drift out of sight. They get involved in things that they shouldn't, or they get involved with other people that they shouldn't, and they're gone. I'm very fortunate that where I preach, the eldership has for years tried to focus on the people. And so I approach them 18 years ago, 15 years ago maybe, to start a new style of singles outreach in my home. Could I start meeting on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights in my home and invite single adults to come? The elders said, that's a great idea, and so it was launched. I think on the first night, there were four of us, my wife, me, and two other people. Within 6 months, there were over 60 people that were involved in that ministry. We averaged close to 50 every Sunday night and every Wednesday night. Now you may ask, where'd you put them all? We put them in bedrooms and we put them in living rooms and we moved out into the garage. We broke up into small groups and spread them out. We got pretty creative. We had to move a couple of times to different locations. But what we found out was that there were young men and young women all over our city who were hungering for something. They were hungering for the gospel of Jesus Christ. They were hungering for fellowship. They weren't finding what they were hungering for at the singles bars. They weren't finding what they were looking for with this group and that group, but they began to come to our home. Most all of them we met for the first time when they came to our house. One young man drove up on a Harley Davidson one night, and I noticed that there's a motorcycle ministry up at the top. If you haven't gone by, you ought to go by and talk to those folks from Duncanville, Texas. It's a great outreach. Well, this fellow was a part of any outreach. He was a surly, sarcastic, obnoxious, he's a brother in Christ, so I can say this. He was a jerk, and he knocked on my door, and when I opened it, he stood there, had his do-rag on, and he said, I understand that there's some sort of a gathering here. And I said, that's right, come on in. He came in. I had to call him down two or three times because he was a little sarcastic. On the third night he was there, he cornered me in the kitchen as I was fixing some snacks for everyone. And he got me up against the refrigerator and he said, someone told me you're a preacher. And I said, well, not a very good one. And he said, I want to tell you, if I had known that, I wouldn't have come the first time. Well, when I learned his story, I found out why. He was told by a preacher when he was 17 years old that if he didn't get his hair cut, he wasn't coming in the church building. So for 17 years, he stayed away. At age 34, he heard about the study at our home. He showed up. About 8 months later, I baptized Marv and four others that night. I think there were about five folks that were brought to Christ. He was responsible for bringing five other people over the course of 2 years to that Bible study. He now lives in the Rogers area. He's got a beautiful wife and two wonderful kids, and his life has been changed. But it was changed because there was some effort put forth for people. One of the young ladies that he invited had just come through a horrible divorce. She'd been beaten physically by her husband and had gone into some severe counseling, and she was the most whipped down, beaten down woman I think I'd ever talked to. In fact, when she came to our house, she knocked on the door like many of us used to knock on the bus ministry doors, hoping that no one would hear her. Fortunately, I was at the kitchen sink and I saw someone come up. I never heard the doorbell ring or knock, and I saw her headed for her car, so I went out and brought her in the house and introduced her to everybody. And about 6 months later, Tina was baptized into Christ. She married one of the young men in that group, and she has a wonderful life today. From that group came 18 baptisms and four restorations. More than half of the group had been divorced. Most of them had been told by somebody where they used to go to church that they were doomed and damned and going to hell because of their divorce. Now, I want to tell you, it's one thing to be lonely. It's one thing to be lonely and feel helpless. It's another thing to be lonely, feeling helpless, and feeling hopeless. They believed that there was no hope for them anywhere. And so they lived as if they had no hope. By the way, if you have not picked up a copy of Reubel Shelley's book, Marriage and Divorce, A Redemptive Theology, you need to race to Boyd's Books right up there on the front line and get one while they're still available. Let me add, of that group, there were 9 marriages that came out of it. Some of those folks were practicing alcoholics. Some of them were practicing addicts. Some of them were recovering alcoholics and recovering addicts. There were others who were what we would call church refugees. They just didn't fit anywhere, or they'd been made to feel unwelcome, so they just simply left and went somewhere else or just went away. Some of them couldn't tell you the difference between John the Baptist and John Wayne. They knew nothing, but they showed up. Now, my reason for telling you all this is not to tell you about the numbers or anything. It's simply to tell you that we had already had a singles ministry in place. It met at the church building. They had a classroom, and nobody came. So we had a program in place, but it was not effective to reach people. And so, thankfully, our leadership felt like that we could certainly do away with the program to reach people. We also found out that there is a network of hurting people out there that we don't know about. Every one of those people touched someone else, and all of the people who came, we had three guys on Harleys one night. I want to tell you, on a Wednesday night at my house, every neighbor on our street was at the door looking with the phone ready to punch 911 because it just looked like we were fixing to have a gang rally there. But hurting people know hurting people, and they respond to a church that touches hurting people. The second thing I would suggest to you very quickly is that you focus on quality and not quantity. Often a church tries to do everything for everybody, and they can't. Unless you're a mega church, and there are very few mega churches among the churches of Christ. There are a lot of reasons why most of us will never reach that point. I'll not go into that. That's another lesson altogether. But the truth is, most of us are moderate to small-sized congregations. We can't do everything. But folks, there are some things we can do, and we can do them very, very well. And we need to find whatever those things are and do them in an excellent manner. Let the community know that the Church of Christ is alive and loves people. Now, tomorrow, again, at 4 o'clock, Marshall Brown's going to share with you some great ideas. Let me share with you real quickly just a couple of ideas that you can take back to your congregation, and I promise you, within 1 week, you can have this ministry in place and affecting people. We have a group of ladies who gather every week for about an hour and a half to write letters and cards. It's not a big thing. They come together for an hour and a half, and they write cards to the people who visit our services, to the people who respond, to the people who are baptized, to the people who are sick, to people who have lost loved ones, to people who just need encouragement. And every week we send a stack out like this. The church pays for the postage, but I promise you, we have more money donated all the time that we spend on postage and envelopes. We have people who aren't members of the church who send us a check and say, put this toward the ministry for all the cards and letters that we received. I don't have time to tell you all the remarkable stories about this, but let me share one. About a month ago, we heard about a young lady that was in Decision Point. It's a pretty hardcore recovery home where you have to go and stay in that place. This young lady had been through Narcotics Anonymous. She had been through Alcoholics Anonymous twice. She was a meth addict. She had been through Decision Point once already. She's 23 years old, and she's pregnant. Her family was just destroyed. She was almost destroyed. We found out about her, and I told the ladies who come up on Wednesday mornings to write, and they just bombarded her. When all the mail went out at Decision Point, some of the folks got one or two letters. Amanda got a whole pile of letters and cards. And I went by to see her, my wife and I did, the next Saturday, and she just broke down and cried. And she said, "You just can't believe all the letters I got. I read them every day. They're sort of my inspiration every day." The next Sunday morning, they let her out to come to church. She came down with her parents that morning to confess sin in her life and to commit her life to Jesus Christ in a better and more meaningful way. And I simply asked the ladies who wrote the cards. I said, "If you don't mind, would you come down here and sit with this folks?" And I explained the situation to them. Well, all five or six of those women came down. There was crying. It was a great time of rejoicing, all because of a card, a letter, a note of encouragement. All over our community, people know about the Church of Christ because they receive cards from us all the time. I just heard about one today that our church secretary told me about, a woman who received a letter this past week, and she said it just absolutely changed her life because she was going through a hard time. Some of you have gotten cards, haven't you? God knew that you needed them at the right time, and you got them at the right time. That's a ministry that you can put into place immediately, a little bit, a few folks doing a little bit over a long period of time. You can let the community know who you are. The second thing that I want to share with you, in your hometown somewhere, there's a shelter. There's some kind of a shelter. There's either an AA group, or there's an NA group, or there's an abused and neglected women's shelter. In our community, there's a shelter for neglected and abused women and children. We've adopted that. A group of our ladies, they call themselves Sisters in Action, and they really are in action. For the last 3 years, this group of ladies has collected and given away through to this shelter to help men, women and children there, about $13,000. And none of the ladies in there are wealthy. People have donated money. We've had contributions given that just defy our imagination. But they prepare a small a packet of personal items for every woman that goes in. Most women are taken out in the middle of the night by the police. They've been abused. They've been beaten up. They've been physically and emotionally and mentally harmed. And their children are taken out. They take nothing with them except their lives. The women don't have nightgowns to sleep in. They don't have pajamas. They don't have personal items. And so the sisters in action will put together a little packet, and every woman gets her own packet. Every child gets their backpack with their own little stuffed animal in it. Received this card just last week, and I want to share part of it with you if I have time. Dear sisters in action, thank you all so much for bringing the backpacks and the goodies for our newest family at Restoration Village. I wanted you all to know how perfect the timing was. The mother of that family was recently put in the hospital for pneumonia. This mother just got her children back the weekend before she got sick. And because she had to stay in the hospital for an unknown amount of time, the children had to go back to their foster family. We gave them their bags and they would not put them down. They wanted to sleep with them. When we took them back to the foster family yesterday, they all had their backpacks on and their stuffed animals in hand. It was something that they could hold on to from mommy's house. For kids who have had so much transition, sometimes a little something that they can hold on to can make a huge difference. Thank you for all of us, from all of us at Restoration Village and from the kids who received the gifts, and I won't read any more. My wife gets to go over there and see that. Other ladies do. I want to tell you, that's something you can go home and start next week, and you can make an impact immediately in your community. And let me tell you something. If you don't think people talk, they do. Every person that goes through there, every person who works there, tells somebody throughout the Rogers area what the Church of Christ did. And we have folks from the community who come and visit us because we heard about what you're doing for those people over there. I'm simply telling you that the buses were wonderful avenues, but there are avenues all over that God's given us to get into folks' lives, get into their homes, and hopefully lead them to Jesus Christ. Tomorrow, once again, Marshall's going to have some great ideas. Boy, don't miss that, please. Let me share a quick story with you, and I'll wrap up here in a few minutes. John Maxwell has written a great book. He's written several great books. One is entitled Winning with People. And the first chapter says, asks the question, am I prepared for relationships? In conjunction with the Luke 14 passage where the master said everything is now ready for you, bring them in. I would ask you, what would happen at your congregation if next Sunday, the Sunday after that, people started coming? What would your congregation do? What would your leadership do if people began to come every Sunday and had needs and wanted to come grow closer to Jesus Christ? If newcomers showed up every Sunday, are you prepared for them? I want to share with you, I'll confess my own weakness in this. One of the things that happened in my life a few years ago that sort of shamed me and got me a little bit better prepared for the time for when people would come. I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous rally. Now, don't write this down. Don't write that I'm an alcoholic, because I'm not. A friend of mine was an alcoholic, and he said, Jackie, I've gotten permission. We're not supposed to, you know, outsiders aren't supposed to come, but this is our annual rally in Eureka Springs, and I'd like to invite you to be my guest, and I got permission for you to come for the big rally on Thursday night. I said, I'd love to come. Folks, I drove over to Eureka Springs. There were 1,500 people in a building designed to hold about 1,000. When I walked in, I was absolutely overwhelmed by the number of people, men and women, old and very, very young. We sat and listened to a man who was who'd been sober for about 40 years and drunk for about 35 or 36 years of his life. He preached for an hour and 20 minutes. Not one person checked their watch. Not one person got restless. Not one person got up to go to the bathroom. Not one person went to sleep for an hour and 20 minutes. I'm not here tonight to endorse and push AA and say, well, the AA is doing more than the church is. But I want to tell you something. They're doing some things that we could learn from. You cannot deny that they've had 50 years of success in helping men and women overcome addiction. You cannot deny that next to the Bible, the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book is the second best-selling book every year. And you cannot deny that they save lives. And they have found methods that work. And I believe that there are methods that you and I can apply in our local congregations. And in the next 7 or 8 minutes, I want to give you 6 of them very quickly. Are you prepared for people to come to your church? Are you prepared for outsiders to come in? Let me tell you where we start. Number one, there is no judging. There is no partiality. There is no judging. I walked in and I was greeted by everyone. I found folks, there were bikers everywhere. Every conceivable garment was made out of leather. I came across every tattoo you can imagine, and every body part that I could see was tattooed or leathered, bearded. There were some skinheads there. I was greeted by old timers who had been in the program for 20, 30, and 40 years. I was greeted by what they call newbies. These were 18 and 19-year-old alcoholics who had been alcoholics since they were 13 years old and were struggling to save their lives. And I found some folks who were normal looking. You know what normal looking folks look like, don't you? You. Yeah, I looked for people who looked like me and sort of gravitated toward them. I was greeted warmly by every single person there. And if we're going to have a church that's going to affect our community for Jesus Christ, we cannot have partiality. We cannot judge people by the way they look. We cannot judge them by the way they talk. We can't judge them by the way they act. The fellow I told you about that came to my home on the Harley Davidson, I ran into him about a month ago. My wife and I had gone out for Mexican food on a Sunday after church, and he and his family were there. And he was talking to 2 construction workers behind him. And he didn't know them. He would talk to anybody. He works for J.B. Hunt. He's a recruiter for J.B. Hunt truck drivers. And he's talked to everybody that he comes in contact with to be a truck driver. If he saw you, Sharon, you'd want to drive a truck. He was talking to these 2 construction workers. He didn't know them from Adam. And he saw me and he jumped up and gave me a big bear hug. And he said, hey, I want you to meet these guys. And he took me over, he introduced me to them. He said, this is a preacher. And they went. I shook their hands, talked with them, cut up with them. Let me tell you, if you want to have a church that's effective, you start by not being prejudiced and not playing partialities with people. Number 2, everybody in AA recognizes they have a common disease. Everybody. When Paul and I walked in and we went through the maze of people, I said, let's get some coffee. And there was a big coffee bar set up. And so we waited through all these folks and we finally got our turn in line. And there were 2 big coffee urns here. And I kept looking back and forth. And finally I said, Paul, which one's decaf? And he said, I don't know. So I asked the lady behind the counter, I said, ma'am, which one is decaf? And she gave me this look. It's the one that has the sign that says decaf. Well, we looked down and there was a sign about this big. Well, Paul and I laughed. The guy behind us said, whew, you guys must be alcoholics. Well, everybody in the room laughed because everybody assumed that we were alcoholics. And I want to tell you, it didn't offend me in the least that they thought I was an alcoholic. Here's why. Alcoholism's not my weakness. But I've got them. And you've got yours. And one thing that the AA folks do is they recognize that everybody has a common disease and a common illness. Number 3, their only concern is to give help. That's all they worry about. In fact, the AA creed reads like this. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Folks, the bottom line for those folks is to help people stay sober. And they don't deviate from that. Do you know what the bottom line for us is? It's Jesus Christ. And we ought not deviate from that. And boy, we do. I'm telling you right here in this wonderful, wonderful group right here, we could start four or five really good church fights if I just brought up several topics. And we'd lose complete focus on what we're doing. If we're going to become a congregation that's going to reach our community, we have got to have a singleness of purpose, and that is to help. Number four, they realize that life is a daily process. Jesus never painted a fantasy picture. He didn't try to sell cheap grace. He simply held out victory and salvation and freedom, and he said, forget your past. Don't worry about your future. Just live today. The man who spoke for an hour and 20 minutes had been sober for almost 40 years, and yet he said several times, I am one day away from being filthy, slobbering drunk. Now, here's how Satan works on my mind and on your mind. I'm 58 years old. I know, I look 57 from where you're sitting, but I'm 58. If I live to be 90, and frankly, I don't, with some of the deacons I work with, I'm not sure that's going to happen, but if I were to live to be 90, that's 32 years. 32 years times 365 days, that's 11,680 days. And if I sat here and every day all I thought about was I've got to be faithful to the Jesus for 11,680, 679, 600, I'd give up. And Satan knows that. Because you can't think that far ahead. That's why Jesus said, you don't have to worry about all those days. You just have to worry about one. Just take care of today, and tomorrow will take care of itself. Fifthly, they saw the value in regular meetings. I met a man who attended at that time 5 to 6 AA meetings every single week. And he said, I'll do that for as long as I live. I met people that attended 3 and 4 meetings. The man who took me attended 3 meetings every single week for 13 years. He just died this past year with cancer. I saw people all over the room passing out business cards and writing down addresses and phone numbers. When you're in my area, give me a call and I'll tell you where we meet. They understand that if they're going to stay sober, they're going to have to meet together. They're going to have the unity of one another and the strength that comes from one another and the ability to hold and bond together. Are you getting my message here? They understand how important meeting together is. And if we're going to become a church that's going to reach a community, we've got to understand the value of one another and how much stronger we are when we bond together. And number six, and lastly, boy, I love this. You can always come back and start over. You can always come back and start over. I told this story about 5 years ago, and I'll tell it again because I love embarrassing Danny Dugan. My wife and I had been married for about 18 months. I never went to church, wasn't going to go to church, didn't care about going to church. She went every Sunday. I did everything that I possibly could to discourage her, and I couldn't. And so one day I finally decided, all right, I'll go. Got up and got dressed, went with her, walked in the building. I walked in the foyer. Someone said, oh, look who's here. And my first impulse was to turn and walk away. Fortunately, the next night, Monday night, Danny Dugan knocked on my door. He introduced himself to me, and he said, Jackie, my name's Danny. Saw you at church Sunday. Just wanted you to know how happy we are that you're here. We'd love to invite you to come back anytime. I won't stay. Just want you to know we love you. And he left. Because of you and others, Jimmy and others, I did come back, and Lord blessed us and blessed us in a way that we could not possibly imagine. When a person comes to the AA meeting for the first time, he's welcomed this way or she's welcomed this way. welcome. Come on in. If that person comes to a meeting for a year or 2 years or 3 years and falls off the wagon and gets drunk and gets thrown in jail and becomes known all over town for their life, and they finally get themselves back together, and they go back 4 or 5 years later to an AA meeting, do you know how they're greeted? Hey, welcome. Come on in. If that person falls away again 5 years later and they go back to the meeting, it's that way every single time. Boy, if we want to learn something from them, we need to greet people that way. Let them know that we love them. Let them know that we care for them. And I promise you, the community that you live in will have a totally different concept of the Church of Christ. And we'll begin to win people for Jesus like never before. 4 o'clock tomorrow, Marshall Brown has some awesome things to say to you. Thank you so much for your time.